Chapter 15. Shaima. If war does not kill the woman in us, it kills the man. Triamus the First, Journals and Dialogues. Like so many who undertake arduous journeys, I left a country of wise men and came back to a nation of fools. Ignorance, like time, brooks no return. Sakwi, 10 Seasons in Zaum. Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Shaima. Soundless light, broken through beads of dew. Dark canvas faces steaming, shadow stretching from engines of war slowly shrinking. Hues of gray bleeding into a panoply of colors. The far tracts of the sea flashing gold. Morning. The beginning of the world's slow bow before the sun. Slaves stirred smoke from the fire pits, used dry grass to conjure flames from buried coals. The sleepless roused themselves, sat in the chill, watching the twining smoke, disbelieving. The first of the horns pealed raw across the distances. The day had come. Shaima awaited, black against a fan of rising light.
"Your father," the old man in Gim had rasped, "bids me tell you."
Kayodia rose from the pastures like a scattered cairn. Foundations snaked through the grasses. Weathered stone crowned the peaks of rambling mounds. Here and there, toppled columns breached the turf, as though the wrecked city had been swamped by the swells of an earthen sea. The warrior prophet wandered the debris, a future mapped with each exhalation. His soul forked into the blackness of possibility, following the calculus of inference and association. Thoughts branching, shoot after shoot, until he filled the immediate world and struck beyond, down into the exhausted soil of the past, out across the ever-receding horizon of the future. Cities burned, entire nations took flight. A whirlwind walked.
"There is but one tree in Kayodia."
Though only dead stone lay scattered about him, Kellis could see what had come before. The grand processionals, the thronging thoroughfares, the ponderous temples. Kayodia had been as great as Shaima, if not greater, in the days when the provinces south of the River Sempus had been nations. Now she was mute and fallow, a place for shepherds to shelter their flocks in time of storm. Glories had dwelt here once. Now there was nothing. Only overturned stone, the whisk of grasses beneath the wind. And answers.
"There is but one tree,"
the old man had said, his voice not his own.
"And I dwell beneath it."
And Kellis had struck, cleaving him to the heart. He had been used, deceived, all along from the very beginning. That had been the Skilvendi's claim. "But I'm not like the others," a Kamian had protested. "I don't believe for my heart's sake." A shrug of powerful, many-scarred shoulders.
"Which is why he would concede you your concerns, make them the ground of an even deeper devotion. Truths are his knives, and we are all of us cut."
"What are you saying?" Ink-bloodied parchment in hand, a Kamian wandered through the camp, pressed through masses of armed and arming and wreathy, neither seeing nor hearing those who bowed and addressed him as holy tutor. He passed from the radial avenues of the Conryan encampment to more haphazard ones of the Tidoni. He saw an armored man, an aging Megarish knight, his beard long and gray, on his knees before the smoking pit of his fire. "Take my hand," a Kamian heard the man sing, "and kneel before." Without warning, the knight opened his eyes, glared at him even as he wiped away his tears. The ensuing verse, "He who raises light," seemed to hang unsung in the air between them. Then he turned, angrily collected his weapons and gear. Horns brayed in the morning distance. "Take my hand," one of 100 hymns to the warrior prophet, most of which Akamian knew by heart. He gazed down the length of the congested avenue, saw others kneeling, some alone, others in groups of two or three. Where the avenue curved out of sight, he could see a judge exhort dozens of penitents. Everywhere he looked, he saw circumfixes, painted across kite shields, wired into necklaces, embroidered across chests and high banners. The entire world seemed to rumble with devotion. How had this happened? What Kellis had said in the apple garden was true. To kneel low before the god was to stand high among the fallen. The servants of an absent king invariably ruled in his stead. What I do, the pious said, I do for him, calling on writs so ancient, so metaphoric, that any hatred or conceit could be interpreted into them. It was as though what transcended, what stood outside the dim and slovenly circle of this life, was nothing more than a sheath hidden beyond the horizon. One needed only reach out to draw weapons. Kneeling. What was it but another outrageous gluttony? Who begrudged sweets when flesh so soon would be served? Even the world found itself on the table, its clamor become music, its caprice become courses served for the sake of the pious alone. Everything was for them. And the others? They need only beg. What are you saying? He had cried to the Skilvendi.
That even you, the proud naysayer, are his slave. That he hunches at the springs of your every thought, draws you as water to his cup.
But my soul is my own.
Laughter, dark and guttural and vicious, as though all sufferers in the end were no more than fools.
He prizes no thought higher.
Macamian had found certainty in Kellis, despite losing Esmenet to him. He'd even made his torment into a kind of proof. So long as his charge pained him, he told himself, it must be real. He did not, as so many did, believe for flattery's sake. Sesuatha's dreams assured that his importance would be more a thing of terror than pride, and his redemption had been a thing too abstract. To love one who had wronged him, that was his test, and he had been rooted, so rooted. Now everything toppled. Hurtled across steepening moments in an avalanche of hungers and hatreds, rushing toward Shaima. He knew not what.
Truths are his knives, and we are all of us cut.
What was happening? To know anything was to know in some measure where one stood. Small wonder he clutched his chest for fear of falling, even here on the wide ground of Sherazor, in the long shadow of Shaima.
Ask yourself, sorcerer, what do you have that he hasn't taken?
He had much preferred his damnation. The fires along the walls of Shaima dulled in dawn's early light. Soon they were little more than orange smears between the battlements. The Fainim upon the walls stared out in wonder across the fields. The impossible sight of the four siege towers, two to either side of the Massus Gate, had dismayed them, for everyone had agreed it would take the idolaters weeks to prepare any assault. Now they watched at the strange formations gathering before the gate proper. Most of them were conscripts, armed with tools or relics of forgotten wars. But some 2,000 survivors of the long backward battle from Mangetta stood among them, and even they were perplexed by the idolaters. Their lord, Hamjirani, was called to the turret so that he might see for himself. For some time he argued with lesser grandees, only to finally withdraw in disgust. Arrayed across the slopes of the Jutaram, the Hill of Ascension, the heathen drummers began beating their skins. As though in reply, Inrithi horns brayed loud, hanging for the length of a man's lungs. Opposite the gate, the Fainim called Pushkar, and the Inrithi called Massus. Small clots of men began advancing over the fields. Across the walls, men cried out for their officers, assuming the idolaters sought to parley. But the nobles among their number shouted them down. Archers were called to the ready. Spread out across 100 or more yards, the formations approached, some 40 of them, each some 10 paces from the others, and consisting, the defenders could now see, of 6 men, five abreast and one back, garbed in crimson beneath silver corselets. Small pennants fluttered from a horn set into their battle caps, a different color and sign adorning each cadre. All their faces were painted white, as was the manner of the Ainani in war. The outermost men bore heavy crossbows, as did a lone man who trailed in the rear. Two like-armored men marched on the inside of the flanking crossbowmen, bearing immense basketwork shields that almost entirely obscured them from anything but the most extreme angles. Save shadows, not much could be seen of the figures who marched between and behind the shields. The more ignorant among the watching Phanum began jeering, but a whisper circulated among them, passing from ear to ear until all was rigid silence. A single Kianine word that even the most ignorant of the Amati knew and feared. Courage. Sorcerer. As though answering a pause in conversation, an otherworldly chorus droned out from the approaching formations, not so much through the air as under the scorched crops and raised structures, and up through the bones of Shima's mighty curtain wall. The engines cast the first of the fire pots. Eruptions of liquid flame revealed the wards curving about each cadre. A cloud swallowed the sunlight, and as one, the defenders saw the foundations of spectral towers. True horror struck them then. Where were Indara's water-bearers? Those Phanum who tried to run were cut down by their own officers. The unholy chorus grew louder. The forward cadres halted some 50 lengths from the ramparts. The odd, panicked arrow winked into smoke against their wards. Columns of foot soldiers streamed forward between the cadres. To the rear of the formations, out of bowshot, several solitary figures stepped into air, their crimson gowns flapping, their eyes and mouths shining bright. There was a collective intake of breath among the battlements. Then, glittering light. The great siege tower Proyas's men called Tippy Toes groaned and creaked as the oxen and slaves pressed it forward across the fields. As the construction neared completion the previous dusk, Ingaiaban had wondered aloud whether the siege tower, which had been constructed to breach Garotha's walls, would be tall enough to give Shima's towers a kiss. With typical wit, Gaideki had replied that, "She need only stand on her tippy toes." Somehow the name had stuck. The great structure dipped and righted itself. Standing upon its packed crown, Proyas tightened an already white-knuckled grip on the railing. Men shouted, both about him and throughout the floors below. The crack of whips rose from behind. Before him, he could see the siege tower's path, marked in the raw dirt the sappers had used to level the irrigation ditches runneling the fields. At the track's end, the white and ochre walls of Shima waited, their heights bristling with heathen men and heathen spears. To his left, Tippito's counterpart, which the men had come to call Sister, lumbered forward as well, matching their progress. Taller than most any tree, she had been sheathed in mats of sodden seaweed, so that she seemed something otherworldly, a limbless beast. Hatches had been propped open along each of her six floors, behind which, Proyas knew, dozens of ballistae stood cocked and waiting, prepared to rake the parapets of the Tatarkar walls as soon as they entered range. The carpenter overseers who had directed the assembly of both towers swore they were miracles of engineering, as they should be, given that the warrior prophet had designed them. Tippy Toes teetered and advanced, her axles and joints screaming. The white-tiled walls and their giant eyes loomed closer. "Please, God," Proyas found himself praying, "let this one thing be." The first of the stones arced toward them, flung by great engines hidden in the city. They fell wide, thumping into the earth short of their positions, but there was something surreal about watching them, as though the soul refused to believe weight so great could be cast so high. Men hollered in warning. A missile whooshed over them, close enough to touch. It missed, but crashed with deadly effect into the long train that drove them forward. Tippy Toes lurched still for a moment, long enough for Sister to pull ahead. Proyas could see her runged backside, which was naught but a giant ladder. Then Tippy-Toes heaved forward again. Count Palatine Gaedeki suddenly appeared among the men crowding the rear of Sister's top platform, his dark face beaming.
"Glory goes to the fleet of foot," he cried. "We'll wash up the blood so you don't slip when you arrive."
Though teeth remained clenched, all laughed, and a number began shouting for more speed. The laughter redoubled when a near hit forced Gaedeki and his men to fairly dive. Then the first of the lights flashed about Massus Gate, and all heads turned. It seemed they could hear screams. Even if sorcery was no longer anathema, few men among the pious, especially among the Conryans, wished to follow the Scarlet Spires anywhere, let alone to Holy Shima. Proyas watched numb as great gouts of flame washed across the barbicans. There was a chorus of plank-muffled shouts from directly beneath him, followed by a staccato snap, as though someone had broken a dozen twigs over his knee. Iron-tipped bolts whirred out from the ballistae arrayed behind the hatches below him, fanned across the teeming parapets. Moments later, Sister responded in kind. Save for those that exploded in small ceramic showers against the wall, the missiles seemed to vanish into the defenders crowding the battlements.
"Shields!" Proyas cried,
not because they would help against the heathen artillery, but because they had come within extreme bow range. Something dimmed the morning sun. Clouds? The first hail of arrows fell upon them and those heaving them forward.
"Fire!"
Proyas cried to the archers about him.
"Clear the walls!"
The Massus Gate had become a mad play of lights in his periphery, but there was no time to watch. With every heartbeat, the unblinking eyes of Shima's walls drew closer and the air grew thicker with missiles. When he dared lower his shield, he could discern individual heathen in the bristling mass of defenders. He glimpsed one old man, a kettle bound to his head, taken in the throat by a bolt and carried backward into the city. Flaming pots crashed about the towers, two smashed into the side of Sister, flinging burning tar across the seaweed. Suddenly, smoke wreathed every sight, and the roar of fire bloated every sound. There was a crack and a concussion that brought all of them to their knees. One of the mighty stones had found its target, but miraculously, Tippy-Toes groaned onward. The floor beneath Proyas heaved like the deck of a ship. He hunched under his shield. The archers about him knocked, stood, fired, then crouched to knock once again. Every second man, it seemed, fell backward, swatting at a jutting shaft. The knights dragged them, dropped them over the side to make room for the others surging up from the lower floors. There was a roar, then a titanic clacking of stones that could only come from the Massus Gate. But a chorus of shrieks drew his attention to his left, to Sister, where a pot had exploded across the upper deck. Burning knights dove, heedless of the height, crashed onto their comrades below.
"Gaedeki!"
Proyas screamed across the interval.
"Gaedeki!"
The Count Palatine's scowling face appeared between the timber hoardings, and Proyas actually smiled, despite the arrows buzzing between them. Then Gaedeki was gone. Proyas slipped to his knees, blinking against the image of the man's neck and shoulders snapping about an unstoppable stone. The sky blackened. Closer and closer the siege towers lumbered, though Sister had become a shining inferno. Then there were the white-tiled walls, close enough to hit with thrown clothing, crammed with arms and howling faces. Proyas could see a great eye opening across the white-tiled plains below, glimpse the wide expanse of street and structure reaching out to the sacred heights.
There was the first temple. Shima, he thought. Shima.
Proyas lowered his silver war mask, glimpsed his stooped kinsmen doing the same. The flying bridge dropped, its iron hooks biting the battlements. Tippy-Toes was tall enough to kiss after all. Crying out to prophet and god, the crown prince leapt into the swords of his enemy. The tree could not be missed. It stood at the edge of a greater hill near the heart of the debris fields, the twin of Black Umiyaki in girth and height. Its great tendons were stripped of their bark, and its limbs reached into the air like winding tusks.
Climbing the remnants of a monumental stair set into the hillside, Kellis soon found himself beneath its massive sinews. Beyond the tree, upturned blocks and rows of headless pillars stretched across the leveled summit. Save in the direction of Shima, where the ground had given way altogether, paving stones encircled the tree's base, rising and cracking about the immense roots. He placed a hand against the immovable trunk, ran his fingertips across the lines that scored its surface, the spoor of old worms. He paused where the ground sheared away, staring at the black clouds that had accumulated on the horizon above Shima. It seemed he could hear the thrum of distant thunder. Then he lowered himself over the fall, using exposed roots to anchor his descent. Sheets of gravel clattered across the slopes below. He found his footing. Above him, the tree soared, its trunk smooth and phallic, its boughs curved like canines, reaching far into the airy heights. Before him, roots twined like cuttlefish limbs. At some point, many years ago from the look of the hatchet work, an opening had been hacked through them. Peering into the excavated gloom, Kella saw the lines of stonework, stairs dropping into blackness. He pressed his way forward, descended into the belly of the hillside. Holding out his hand to alert Serwe and her brother, Nayor reined his stolen horse to a hard stop. Four vultures took soundlessly to the sky. On the slopes of a neighboring rise, five saddled but riderless horses momentarily raised their heads, then continued grazing. The three of them had paused on a low rise overlooking the carnage. The Betmula Mountains rose gray and hunched in the distances before them, and there was still no sign of Kayudia, though Serwe insisted they followed the Dunyane's path exactly. She could smell him, she said. Nayor dismounted, strode into the midst of the sprawled bodies. He hadn't slept for days, but the exhaustion that buzzed through his limbs seemed an abstract thing, as easily ignored as a philosopher's argument. Ever since his discussion with the Mandate Sorcerer, a strange intensity had seized him, a vigor he could only identify with hate. He goes to Kayudia, the fat fool had finally said.
Kayudia?
Yes, Shima's ruined sister. It lies to the southwest, near the headwaters of the Jeshimal.
Did he tell you why?
No one knows. Most think he goes to speak with the god.
Why do they think that?
Because he said he goes to his father's house.
Kidrahil,
Nayor called back, identifying the dead.
Likely hunting us.
He stared at the tracks across the ground, then stooped to examine several of the corpses. He pressed knuckles against the cheek of one, gauging its warmth. The skin spies watched impassively, stared with unnerving directness as he walked back and remounted his horse.
The Dunyane surprised them, he said.
How many seasons had he pined for this moment? How many thoughts scattered and broken?
I shall kill them both.
Are you sure it was him? Her brother asked. We smell others. Feign him.
Nayor nodded and spat.
It's him,
he said with weary disgust.
Only one had time to draw his weapon.
War. She realized. War had given the world to men. They had fallen to their knees before her, the men of the Tusk. They had beseeched her for her blessing.
Shima!
One man had cried.
I go to die for Shima!
And Esmanet did, though she felt foolish and so very far from the idol they seemed to make of her. She blessed them, saying words that would give them the certainty they so desperately needed, to die or to kill. In a voice she knew so well, at once soothing and provoking, she repeated something she had heard Kella say. Those who do not fear death live forever. She held their cheeks and smiled, though her heart was filled with rot. How they had thronged about her, their arms and armor clattering, all of them reaching, aching for her touch, much as they had in her previous life. And then they left her with the slaves and the ill. The Whore of Sumna, some had called her, but in tones of exultation, not condemnation, as though only by falling so far could one be raised so high. She found herself thinking of her namesake from the Chronicle of the Tusk, Esmenet, wife of Angeshrael, daughter of Shamanet. Was that her fate, to be a reference buried among holy articles? Would they call her Esmenet Alakal, or Esmenet the Other, the way the tractate distinguished those with namesakes from the Tusk? Or would she simply be the prophet consort, the whore of Sumna? The sky darkened, and the murderous roar swelled on the morning breeze. At long last, it was happening, and she could not bear it. She could not bear it. Ignoring several entreaties to go watch the assault from the edge of the encampment, she returned to the umbilica. It was deserted, save for a handful of slaves gathered about their breakfast fires. Only one of the 100 pillars, a Galioth with a bandaged thigh, stood guard. He bowed low and stiff as she barged past him into the closeted murk of the interior. She called out twice as she walked the tapestried halls, received no reply. All was quiet, still. The clamor of the holy war seemed impossibly distant, as though she listened to another world through the joints of this one. Eventually she found herself in the dead Padi Raja's bedchamber, staring at the great gilded bed where she and Kellis slept and coupled. She piled her books and scrolls on it, then, crawling across the covers, surrounded herself with them. Rather than read, she touched, savored their smooth and dry surfaces. Some she held until they became as warm as her skin. Then, for no reason she could fathom, she counted them, like a child jealous of her toys. 27, she said to no one. Distant sorceries cracked faraway air, made the golden glass settings hum with their rumble. 27 doors opened, and not one way out. Esme, a hoarse voice said. For a moment, she refused to look up. She knew who it was. Even more, she knew what he looked like. The desolate eyes, the haggard posture, even the way his thumb combed the hair across his knuckles. It seemed a wonder that so much could be hidden in a voice, and an even greater wonder that she alone could see. Her husband, Drusus Akamian. Come, he said, casting a nervous glance about the room. He did not trust this place. Please, come with me. Through the canvas warren, she could hear Moengus's infant wail. She blinked tears and nodded, always following. Screams, men combusting, burning like autumnal leaves, trailing oily ribbons of black, thunder upon thunder, a chorus roaring at depths only the shivering stone could hear. Those cringing along the inner base of the fortifications saw the shadows of battlements flicker across the nearby tenements. The heads of ghost dragons reared from the forward scarlet cadres. Then, like dogs straining for their master's hand, they bent forward and vomited incendiary streams. Fire gushed up across masonry, orange and gold in the gloom, blazing between crenellations, swirling down stair and ramp, rolling over men and transforming them into flailing shadows. Within heartbeats, the phanum packed across the barbican and adjacent walls ceased to exist. Stone cracked, exploded. The bastions of the gate buckled, and men winced as though watching knees fold backward. The towers leaned out through the smoke, then dropped into obscurity. A great hemisphere of dust and debris rolled out and over the sorcerers and their unearthly song. At long last, the scarlet spires marched. Kellis climbed through deeper ruins. At the base of the stair, he found a lantern made of horn and translucent paper, something neither Kianin nor Nilnameshi in manufacture. When ignited, it cast a diffuse orange glow. The halls were not human. The drafts came to him, murmuring their secrets. His soul reached out, calculating probabilities, transforming inferences into space. About him, the gallery scrawled on and on into the immured blackness. So like the thousand halls, so like Ishual. Kellis forged ahead, the scattered detritus cracking beneath his feet.
He watched the walls resolve from cold blackness, studied the mad detail that thronged across them. Statuary, not reliefs, had been carved into them. Figures no taller than his knee, posed in narratives that outran the light of his lantern and stacked one atop another, even across the vaulted ceiling, so that it seemed he walked through stone grillwork. He paused, held his lantern before a string of naked figures raising spears against a lion, then realized that another frieze had been carved behind this first. Peering through miniature limbs, he saw deeper, more licentious representations, depicting all manner of poses and penetrations, the work of non-men. A trail had been scuffed across the hide of ancient dust, and by someone, Kellis realized, who possessed a stride and gait identical to his own. Following it, he pressed deeper into the derelict mansion, knowing that he walked in his father's very footsteps. After descending several hundred paces, he entered a domed vestibule, where the renderings across the walls were chiseled large as life, but continued telling the same twofold tale of martial exploit and priapic excess. Copper bands, their bright green bleeding into the limestone, had been set into the walls, bearing a strange wedge script. But whether they were benedictions, explanations, or recitations of some hallowed text, Kellis could not say. He knew only that the inhabitants of this place had celebrated deeds in all their ambivalent complexity, rather than, as was the wont of men, reproducing only flattering surfaces. Ignoring the alternate passages, Kellis continued following the track through the dust. It wound deep into the abandoned labyrinth, always descending. Save for the pitted remains of bronze arms, he found no artifacts, only chamber after florid chamber, each as ornate as the last. He passed through a vast library, where scroll racks towered higher than his lantern light could reach, and where queues and twining stairs, all exquisitely carved from living rock, loomed from the darkness as though from the ocean deeps. He did not pause, though he held out his lantern to each room he passed by or through. Infirmaries, granaries, barracks, and personal apartments, warrens of them. Everything he saw, he pondered, knowing he understood nothing of the souls for whom these things were natural and immediate. He pondered 4,000 years of absolute dark. He crossed a vast processional gallery where sculptured events spilled from the walls, epic scenes of strife and passion, nude penitents prostrate before the court of a non-man king, warriors striving against mobs of Srank or men. Though Moengus's trail often passed through these grand dioramas, Kellis found himself walking around, heeding some voice from nowhere. Towering columns soared into the darkness, worked with arms, gripping arms, twining upward and around, squared with bent-back wrists and open hands that cast the shadow of fingers. The ceilings remained cloaked in black obscurity. The silence was that of mighty hollows, at once oppressive and fragile, as though the clatter of a single stone might thunder. Upraised palms braced his every step. Blank eyes studied his every angle. The non-men who had authored this place had possessed more than a fascination with a living form. It had been their obsession. Everywhere, they had cut their image into the dead stone about them, transforming the suffocating weights that hemmed them in into extensions of themselves. And Kellis realized the mansion itself had been their devotional work, their temple. Unlike men, these non-men had not rationed their worship. They did not distinguish between prayer and speech, idol and statue, which spoke to their terror. Collapsing possibilities with every step, Anassarimber Kellis followed his father's trail into the blackness, his lantern raised to the issue of artisans, ancient and inhuman.
Where are you taking me?
Nowhere. Nowhere good. He said nothing as he led her through the encampment, away from Shima, toward the greening heights to the west. She too said nothing, and spent much of the journey watching the grass stain the toes of her white silk slippers. She even made a game of it, kicking through the tangle of blades and stalks purposefully.
Once she even wandered to her right so that she might walk across untrod ground, and for a moment it almost seemed they were Akamian and Esmanet once again, condemned and derided rather than exalted or revered. The sorcerer and his melancholy whore. She even dared clutch his chill hand. What harm could come of it? Please, keep walking. Let us flee this place. Only when they passed through the final battery of tents did she actually notice him, the forward fixed eyes misted by inscrutable thoughts, the strong jaw working beneath the plaits of his beard. They began climbing toward the very gutted mausoleum where she had found Kellis the night previous. It seemed different in daylight somehow. The walls.
You never came to Zin's funeral, he finally said.
She squeezed his hand.
I couldn't bear to.
Her voice faltered, speaking the words. They seemed cruel, horribly so, despite what she herself had suffered the night the Marshal of Atrempus died.
His only friend. Was the fire bright? She asked,
the customary question. He climbed several more steps, his sandaled feet swishing through yellow-blooming bitterweed. Several bees spun in angry circles, buzzing through the thunder that rumbled across the distances, the clamor of battle. Through some trick of sound, the faint raving of one man floated to the fore, at once hoarse and metallic.
The fire was bright.
The bricked ruin rose before them, its foundations ringed with thronging sumac and weeds. Poplars shot young and straight from the interior, brushing the highest of the truncated walls with their branches. She wondered at details that had escaped her in the gloom with Kellis, at the webbed nest of caterpillars bobbing in the breeze, at the ovals which might once have been faces set into the eastward walls.
What am I doing?
For an absurd instant, she found herself fearing for her life. Many men would have murdered her for crimes she had committed. What about Akamian? Could Loss have unearthed such a man within him? But then, unaccountably, she was angry at the way he had yielded her.
You should have fought for me.
Why are we here, Akka? Oblivious to her mad thoughts, he turned with one arm held wide, as though boasting of hard-won lands.
I wanted you to see this, he said.
Following his hand, she looked out across the encampment, whose tent-enclosed avenues wheeled out in broken seashell patterns over the raised groves, fields, and buildings of the intervening ground. And there it was, scored by pluming smoke, motionless and gloomy beneath the preternatural dark of the sky. Shima. From their seaward faces, the Tatokar walls wound white as teeth about the warren of street and structure that engulfed the heights of the Jutarum. Both the ground and the parapets winked with flashing arms. The two siege towers given to Proyas were pressed against the ramparts, surrounded by lines and squares of men. The northern one burned like a miniature paper votive. A great pillar of smoke rose from what had been the Massus Gate, leaning low over the city, its nethers burnished by the wicked glare of sorceries. To either side, several of the great eyes had been broken, and the towers appeared abandoned. Farther to the south, on the far side of the ruined aqueduct, the two siege towers given to Kinjoza had also reached the walls, and dark masses of Ainani teemed about their bases, queuing to climb their runged backs. And in the near distance, clear through passing sheets of smoke, stood the first temple. She raised a bald fist to her brow. Perhaps it was some trick of scale or perspective, but it all seemed so slow, as though it happened through water or something more viscous than human understanding. Nevertheless, it happened.
We've gained the heights,
she said, a murmur that somehow became a cry.
The city is ours!
She turned to Akamian, who seemed to watch with the same horror and wonder, awe, that numbed her expression.
Akka, can't you see? Shima falls. Shima falls.
There had been so much in these words, far more than fervor, far more than the tears that clotted her eyes. Love, rape, and revelation, disease, starvation, and massacre, everything they had survived, everything she had endured. But he shook his head, his eyes still fixed on the vista before them.
It's all a lie.
Horns pealed to the lowing clouds. What? He turned to her, his look possessed by a terrifying blankness. She recognized it, for the same blankness had owned her eyes the night he had returned to Karaskand.
The Skilvendi came to me last night.
Fainim drums throbbed. The clouds continued to darken, answering to the Kishorim and their malevolent will. Urged on by the cries of their captains, phalanxes of Javra charged the slopes, clamoring across the heaped ruin of the Mass's gate, then sprinted into the towering veils of smoke that slowly drifted across the city. The first of the scarlet cadres followed, picking their way forward carefully, keeping their sorcerers shielded at all times. The outlines of the surviving walls resolved from the haze, and as the formations passed beneath them, geysers of glittering fire reached up to lave their heights. More stonework came tumbling to ground. The world itself seemed to mutter curses. Sarasthenes was the first of the Scarlet Schoolmen to set foot in Shima, followed by Taramis the Older, and Tai, who despite his great age, continually scolded his Javra for their sloth. Before them loomed a warren of alleyways and buildings that stretched to the foot of the Jutarum. Their Javra pickets fanned out in their hundreds, cutting down hapless Amati, sifting through the buildings. Screams pealed out from hidden places. Taramis the Older was the first to die, struck in the shoulder by a kore as he pressed his cadre forward. He fell to the street, cracked like statuary. Bellowing arcana, Tai sent flocks of burning sparrows into the black windows of the adjacent tenement. Explosions spit blood and debris across the street. Then, from the ruins of the outer wall, Inrumi struck the building's westward face with brilliant lightning. The air cracked. Burnt brick walls sloughed to the ground. In an exposed room, a burning figure stumbled over the lip of the floor and plummeted to the ruin below. Sheltered by his Javra and their wide shields, Eleazarus gained the summit of the ruined masses, surveyed his cadres deploying before him. He leaned against the iron prongs jutting from the debris at his feet, the remains of the portcullis. Though he couldn't see Taramis, he knew that something had already happened. They had hoped to draw the snakeheads out in a decisive engagement, but Siakti was too canny. The Shigeki fiend, it appeared, hoped to bleed them, pick them off one by one. Eleazarus looked across the maze of structures before him, the welter of walls and rooftops extending to the slopes of the Jutarum and marble bastions of the first temple upon its summit. He could sense the Kore out there, buried in cellars, crouched in lethal vantages, waiting. Everywhere. Hidden enemies. Too much. Too many.
Fire cleanses! He cried. Raise it! Burn it all to ash!
The long-awaited horns sounded, a coarse peal over the throb of heathen drums. Towering amid his shield brothers, Yalgrota Srankhammer raised his axe to the darkling sky, howled bloodthirsty oaths to Gilgeol, mighty war. His kinsmen answered with raucous shouts. Then the Thunieri surged into the Scarlet Schoolman's wake, racing over the smoking ruins of the Massus Gate. Shattered tile cracked beneath their booted feet. To their north, Proyas and his Conryans battled across the parapets. Of their two siege towers, one had been lost to Inferno, but hundreds clambered up the back of the other, dashing through arrows to reinforce their prince. To their south, Kinjoza and his Einani watched with amazement as the Fainim defenders fled the ponderous approach of their two siege towers. Bellicose Uranyanka and his Maserati would be the first of their number to set foot upon the Tatokar walls. The black-armored Thunieri spilled unopposed into the city. Prince Hulwarga and Earl Gokin struck south, leading the Skagwi and the wild-haired Oglishmen into the unruined streets behind the Einani section of the wall. Earl Ganbrota, meanwhile, drove north with his Ingrawlish, their shields adorned with shrunken heads. The east they left to the Scarlet Gorwicka and their dark-skinned slaves. Soon the Kianine and Amati were dissolving in panic. Everywhere they looked, they saw chain-armored myriads, loosed like blonde wolves into the streets. The lantern faltered, and for a moment Kellis cradled it as though trying to coax it to life with the fire of his own body. With a final hiss, it faded into nothing. But that was not the end of light. He saw the faintest of glimmers off to his right, toward the sound of booming water. Rather than use any cant that might announce his presence, he continued in blackness. The sound grew more and more thunderous as he followed the pitch hallway. A fine mist sheened his skin, matted his hair and robe. The light grew more and more distinct, orange shining across the black of wet stone. Twice he stooped, drew his fingers across the floor to ensure that he still followed his father's trail. The hallway opened onto a balcony that overlooked a vast cavern. At first, all he could discern were the mighty curtains of water tumbling from abyssal blackness, and on such a scale that the flooring beneath him seemed to float upward. Then he noticed the points of light below, several of them, arrayed across a platform beyond the waterfall's reach and reflected in the oily surface of some kind of pool. Braziers, he realized, dim burning because of the sodden air.
Father?
Kellis descended a broad stair hewn from the walls. As elsewhere in the mansion, every surface had been rendered with heroic carvings across more pornographic reliefs, though on a far greater scale. Kellis could make out immense vaults, their tangled figures encrusted with the mineral residue of water and millennia. The falls themselves towered into darkness, raucous, white foam wheeling, dropping with the weight of glaciers, so tall they threatened to press him to his knees. A series of chutes, like halved versions of the long curved horns the Thunieri used to communicate in battle, had been raised to the tumbling skirts of the waterfalls. There were dozens of them, hooking outward and downward, arranged to convey water to the sprawling floor below, though only three still reached into the crashing white, the others having broken. Green about the edges, they gleamed copper where the water still runneled them. The stair wound away from the falls, curled across the back of the vast chamber where it met its mirror image and broadened in a monumental fan. Bronze weaponry and armor lay scattered across the steps, remnants of the ancient battle that had been lost here. As he neared the stair's base, the sounds of smaller waters were braided into the background roar, the gurgling of eaves and the slap and whish of small streams across stone. A cavernous must permeated the air.
They gathered here in the hundreds,
a voice called across the gloom, clear despite the ambient rumble.
Even thousands in the days before the womb plague.
A Kunayuric voice. Kellis paused on the steps, searched the gloom.
At last.
As broad as the Syracuse Arena in Momum, the floor opened before him, matted with detritus and the small mounds which were all that remained of the fallen. Ripples dilated in endless procession across the broad pool set in the floor's center. Like a black mirror, it reflected the braziers burning along its far rim, the fat bronze faces looming over them, and the great cascading column of the waterfall. At the terminus of the chutes, a series of immense bronze statues had been erected. Kneelers, obese and naked, with channels cut into their backs, and with heads hollowed into great jowled masks. They squatted in a broad semicircle facing the pool, their expressions lurid in the orange light. Water streamed from the eyes and mouths of three of them, slapping across the stone. The hollowed head of one had broken off altogether. It now rested near the far end of the pool, its single, unsubmerged eye staring across the black waters.
Bathing was holy for them,
the voice continued. Kellis descended the last of the monumental stair, slowly walked across the floor. He had grown accustomed to listening through voices, but this one was smooth as porcelain, seamless and inscrutable. Even still, he knew it very well. How could he not, when it was his own? Advancing around the pool, he saw a pale figure sitting cross-legged behind the sheets of water that poured from one of the monstrous faces. A man, white-skinned, obscured by rushing translucence.
The fires are for you,
the figure said.
I have lived in darkness for a long, long time.
Her calm terrified Akamian almost as much as the clamor on the horizon. The very wind stank of sorcery.
So he uses everyone, she finally said. His every word is bent upon manipulation.
She stared as though her eyes had forgotten how to blink.
Don't you mean he uses me?
I haven't thought it all through yet, but I think he wants children. Children with his strength, his intellect, and you.
So he breeds? Is that it? I'm his prized mare?
I know how hateful these words must.
Why would you think that?
I've been used my whole life. She paused, glared at him with as much remorse as outrage.
My whole life, Akka. And now that I've become the instrument of something higher, higher than men and their rotting hunger?
But why? Why be an instrument at all?
You speak as if we had a choice. You, a mandate schoolman. There's no escape, you know that. With every breath we are used.
Then why the bitterness, Esme? Shouldn't a prophet's vessel sound ex-
Because of you, Akka!
She cried with alarming ferocity.
You! Why can't you just let me go? You know that I love you, so you cling to that. You dig in with grubby nails and you yank and yank and yank. You bruise and batter my heart and you refuse to let me go.
Esme, I asked and you came. Long silence.
All this, she said,
her voice almost inaudible for the crack of faraway sorceries.
Everything Nayor said. What makes you think that Kellis hasn't already told me?
Akamian swallowed, ignored the lights that flashed across his periphery. Because you say you love him. Cymbals crashed in a relentless tempo, measuring the hellish advance of the Scarlet Spires. They laid waste to all before them. Whatever resistance the heathen mustered, they puffed out like candle flames. Companies of horsemen, bowmen, arrayed across the rooftops, all mummified in anagogic fire. Save for the adept watchers who walked the sky in their wake, most of the 74 surviving sorcerers of rank marched on foot through the conflagration, sheltering themselves and their Javra shieldmen with wards. Bathed in the light of successive cants, each cadre trailed a flickering array of shadows. They climbed ramps of blackened stone, mounds of smashed brick, found their footing, and worked more thunderous devastation. Stones arced skyward, trailing streamers of smoke. Cornices and pillars collapsed upon their footings, swallowed by the black billowing issue of their destruction. The whole world seemed rendered in luminous bloods and abyssal blacks. They stepped over sizzling limbs. Above towering flames and through curtains of smoke, the first temple and the tesseract loomed ever closer until they encompassed the horizon. Again and again, the Scarlet Schoolman called out with destruction, but none would answer. The Phanum ran before them, like flame-maddened beasts. Only the sky. Of all this world, only the sky offered them surcease, a momentary reprieve from spikes of terrestrial congestion. Through furnace eyes, they gazed across the world's dark curvature. The sun flared white and preternaturally bright. Thunderheads roiled beneath, trailing into nothingness in the distance, like snow kicked across ice. They saw pale coastlines, vast tracts of bleached ochre and blue. They flexed their frames in languorous vanity, beat their air-scooping wings. Zayaz, Setmahaga, Sohorat. Only here, at the limits of this cursed world. Then the voice called them, crackling with torment and rebuke. As one, they bent their elephantine heads back, howled into the indigo depths, then plunged backward, diving into the skein of angry clouds, wind-burned eyes that could not tear. Like stones, they dropped from the belly of the clouds. Shaima encircled the nearing ground, dark save where fire scored her. They sensed the mortals, loping like monkeys down murky streets, raping, murdering, warring. Would that they could devour it all. But the voice, like a thing of needles, more agonizing than the million teeth of this surrounding world. They soared toward the city's heart, following the yaw and pitch of the eastern wind, then alighted, one after another, on the eaves of the first temple. The voice approved. They flattened like beetles against the slate. They could sense the eyeless ones within, waiting.
"Fall upon them!" the voice screeched. "Rend them! Only in their midst will you be safe from the Koray!"
They smashed through the shingles, tore aside the braces, cracked the great stone lintels asunder, then dropped in a hail of debris. A dozen saffron-robed men scrambled about them, blue lights flashing from their foreheads. Great arcs of energy sizzled across their incandescent hides. Sohorat roared, and plaster rained throughout the forest of columns. Flies burst from his maw. Raving wolves bubbled from his palms, smashed the sheets of light, gorged on those cringing behind them. Zayaz swept burning threads into his fist, wrenched souls from their housing meat. Set Mahagar clawed aside flimsy defenses, struck heads from bodies, gloried in the blood that smoked across his limbs. He squealed like a thousand pigs, such was his exultation.
"Demon!"
a voice like a thunderclap. They turned from the blood-soaked marble, saw an old eyeless man approach from the deeper temple. Something flashed from his forehead, like a stolen star. Others spilled between the flanking columns, more blind men.
"Flee!"
the voice whispered in his soul. Set Mahaga fell first, struck in the eye by an absence affixed to the end of a stick, an explosion of burning salt.
"Flee!"
Then Sohorat, his slavering form caught in torrents of light, screamed. Zayaz leapt into the clouds.
"Return me, manling! Throw off these chains!"
But the scarlet schoolman was obstinate.
"One last task, one more offending eye."
Water everywhere, falling in thundering cataracts, singular drops, and draping sheets. Kellis paused next to one of the shining braziers, peered beneath the bronze visage that loomed orange and scowling over his father, watched him lean back into absolute shadow.
"You came to the world," unseen lips said, "and you saw that men were like children."
Lines of radiance danced across the intervening waters.
"It is their nature to believe as their fathers believed," the darkness continued, "to desire as they desired. Men are like wax poured into molds. Their souls are cast by their circumstances. Why are no Phanom children born to Enrithi parents? Why are no Enrithi children born to Phanom parents? Because these truths are made, cast by the particularities of circumstance. Rear an infant among Phanom, and he will become Phanom. Rear him among Enrithi, and he will become Enrithi. Split him in two, and he would murder himself."
Without warning, the face re-emerged, water garbled, white save the black sockets beneath his brow. The action seemed random, as though his father merely changed posture to relieve some vagrant ache. But it was not. Everything, Kellis knew, had been premeditated. For all the changes wrought by 30 years in the wilderness, his father remained Dunyane, which meant that Kellis stood on conditioned ground.
"But as obvious as this is," the blurred face continued, "it escapes them. Because they cannot see what comes before them, they assume nothing comes before them. Nothing. They are numb to the hammers of circumstance, blind to their conditioning. What is branded into them, they think freely chosen. So they thoughtlessly cleave to their intuitions and curse those who dare question. They make ignorance their foundation. They confuse their narrow conditioning for absolute truth."
He raised a cloth, pressed it into the pits of his eyes. When he withdrew it, two rose-colored stains marked the pale fabric. The face slipped back into the impenetrable black.
"And yet, part of them fears.
For even unbelievers share the depth of their conviction. Everywhere, all about them, they see examples of their own self-deception. Me, everyone cries. I am chosen. How could they not fear when they so resemble children stamping their feet in the dust? So they encircle themselves with yea-sayers and look to the horizon for confirmation, for some higher sign that they are as central to the world as they are to themselves. He waved his hand out, brought his palm to his bare breast, and they pay with the coin of their devotion.
And what of you, Akka? Esmanet said, her voice become scathing. Haven't you yielded your precious gnosis as readily as I've yielded my womb?
Why couldn't she just hate him, this drab and broken sorcerer? It would all be so much easier then. Akkamian cleared his throat.
Yes, yes, I have. Then tell me why, holy tutor. Why would a mandate schoolman do such an unthinkable thing?
Because the second apocalypse, it comes.
The very world is at stake, and you complain that he makes weapons of all things? Akka, you should rejoice.
I'm not saying he's not the harbinger. He may even be a prophet for all I know.
Then what are you saying, Akka? Do you even know?
Two tears threaded his cheeks.
That he stole you from me. Stole!
Picked your purse, did he? That's funny, because I feel more shit than gold.
It's not like that.
Isn't it? You love me, yes, Akka, but I've never been anything more than a...
But you're not thinking! You see only your love for him. You're not thinking of what he sees when he gazes upon you.
A moment of silent horror.
But he lies. The Skilvendi lies. I'm Nansur. I know.
Tell me, Esme. Tell me what he sees.
She shook. Why was she shaking? The earth seemed like stone beneath her knees.
The truth,
she murmured.
He sees the truth.
Somehow his arms had scooped her to her feet, and she clutched him, sobbed and wailed into his shoulders. He whispered into her ear,
He doesn't see, Esme. He watches.
And the words were there, at once deafening and unspoken. Without love. She looked up to him, and he stared at her with an intensity, a desperation she knew she would never find in Kellis's endless blue eyes. He smelled warm, bitter. His lips were wet. Eleazarus gazed across the infernal landscape. He could hear himself cackle, but he knew not the voice. What was this, he felt? Glee, dark and gloating, like watching a hated sibling struck at last? Remorse and fear, terror even. It was as though he dropped and dropped and never struck ground. And yes, omnipotence, like liquor burning through his veins, or opium sweltering his soul. Like the specters of decapitated snakes, dragon heads reared above various cadres and masticated about streaming fire. To his immediate right, someone, Nem Panipal, sang boiling clouds of black. Lightning flashed out in a blinding skein. Stone exploded outward. Shearing along a diagonal, a tower fell onto the ruins of its own foundation, where it lay like an overturned hull. The Grandmaster cackled as the wave of dust rolled over him. Shaima burned. Shaima burned! Somehow Sarasthenes, his shield-bearers nowhere to be seen, had found his way to his side. Why would the fool risk...
You'll press too hard,
the rail-thin sorcerer cried. Lines of black scored his rutted face, where he had wiped it flecks of soot, no doubt.
You exhaust us on women, children, and dumbstone. Kill them,
Eleazarus spat.
I care not.
But the Kishorum, Eli, we must conserve ourselves.
For some reason, he thought of all the slaves who had swallowed his member, of clutching tight silken sheets, of the luxurious agony of release. This was what it was like, he realized. He had seen them, the men of the Tusk, filing back from battle, matted in blood, smiling with those terrifying eyes. As though to show those eyes to Sarasthenes, he turned to the man,
held out a hand to the sulphurous calamity before them.
Behold, he spat contemptuously. Behold what we have wrought.
The soot-stained sorcerer stared at him in horror. Lights flashed across his sweaty cheek. Eleazarus turned back to exult in the wages of his impossible labor. Shima burned. Shima.
Our power, he grated. Our glory!
From the parapets of the Miraz Gate, Proyas gazed in disbelief. A vast plate of clouds, dark, churning in unnatural, ingrown ways, moved in ponderous revolutions about the city, taking the sacred heights as its axis. Simply staring at it dizzied his footing. From where he stood, the first temple seemed impossibly near. He could even see armored men, Phanum, emerge from the darkness beyond the outermost ring of pillars, bounding down stairs and across landings before disappearing behind the battlements of the Heterene Wall. But what dismayed him was the great curtain of smoke and fire that approached the heights from the ruins of the Massus Gate. Chalk-white streamers, mists of ochre dust, rolling veils of gray, plumes like liquid basalt, solid and black. And through them, glowering fires, threads of lightning, and flying cataracts of gold. Whole tracts of the city had been blasted and consumed, reduced to a great thumb of smoldering ruin. Ingaiaban laughed maniacally.
Have you ever seen such a thing?
Proyas turned to rebuke him, only to glimpse a figure draped in shimmering crimson picking his way over the matted dead immediately behind them. The man teetered for a moment, skidding in blood. His iron-gray braid swung across his left shoulder.
What are you doing?
Proyas cried. The scarlet schoolman ignored him, took up a position facing west, and stretched his arms wide beneath the sky.
You're destroying the city!
The old man whirled so quickly that his ornate gowns were a heartbeat in following. Despite his phlegmatic eyes and stooped frame, his voice was as forceful as it was furious.
Conrayan ingrate! The Kishorum own the skies. They use the darkness to hide their quarry. If we lose this contest, then all is lost, do you understand? Holy Shima! Fire on your fucking city!
Shocked as much by the man's bearing as by his vehemence, Proyas retreated a step, speechless. Cursing, the schoolman returned to his task, and Proyas found himself peering down the wall to the nearest tower. Tiny figures teemed atop the parapet, and among them, another white-bearded schoolman stood leaning against the battlements, his arms held out to the west, his eyes flaring bright as he sang. Black clouds ribbed the sky above, though the Menenor beyond still winked blue and white, bathed in distant sunshine. The sorcerer before Proyas began singing as well. A sudden wind bellied his gaping sleeves, and a voice whispered,
No, not like this.
Screens of tumbling water breaking the world beyond them into glittering lines and smeared shadows. Kellis had ceased trying to penetrate them.
Power, Anasarimber Moenga said, is always power over. When an infant may be either, what is the difference between a Phanum and an Enrithi, or between a Nansur and a Skilvendi? What could be so malleable in men that anyone split between circumstances could be his own murderer? You learned this lesson quickly. You looked across wilderness and you saw thousands upon thousands of them, their backs bent to the field, their legs spread to the ceiling, their mouths reciting scripture, their arms hammering steel. Thousands upon thousands of them. Each one a small circle of repeating actions, each one a wheel in the great machine of nations. You understood that when men stop bowing, the emperor ceases to rule, that when the whips are thrown into the river, the slave ceases to serve. For an infant to be an emperor, or a slave, or a merchant, or a whore, or a general, or whatever, those about him must act accordingly. And men act as they believe.
You saw them in their thousands, spread across the world in great hierarchies, the actions of each exquisitely attuned to the expectations of others. The identity of men you discovered was determined by the beliefs, the assumptions of others. This is what makes them emperors or slaves, not their gods, not their blood. Nations live as men act, Moenga said, his voice refracted through the ambient rush of waters. Men act as they believe, and men believe as they are conditioned. Since they are blind to their conditioning, they do not doubt their intuitions. Kellis nodded in wary assent. They believe absolutely, he said. He found himself clutching her hand, pulling her away toward the derelict mausoleum. He saw her smile despite her tears, her face so heartbreakingly beautiful, while beyond her, just to the left of her cheek, the first temple, freckled small in the distance, presided over smoke and burning streets. The walls had collapsed to their footings at the mausoleum's southeastern corner. He stepped over them, sweeping weeds flat with a sandaled foot. He drew her into the interior, into the dappled gloom where the young trees had rooted. Insects whirred up into the last of the sunlight. They kissed again, embraced in a more profound manner. Then they were upon the ground, cold, hard, and matted with living things. No, something whispered within him. Not like this. Not like this. And he knew, they both knew, what it was they were doing. Blotting one crime with another. But he couldn't stop. Even though he knew she would hate him afterward, even though he knew that was what she wanted. Something unforgivable. She was weeping, whispering things, inaudible things. It seemed the roaring of ache and need and accusation was all a Kamian could hear. What am I doing? I can't hear you, he murmured, fumbling with the tails of her gown that had bunched between her legs. Why so frantic? What was this terror he felt? Sweet Sejanus, how could a heart pound so hard? Please, please. Beneath him, she rocked her face back and forth, bit the knuckle of her thumb. We're dead, she gasped. He does love me. He will kill. Then a Kamian was inside her. They fled the walls, the Amati and their Kianine overseers, and ran into the darkening streets. The Iron Men had come with blistering sorceries and shrieking horns, the accursed idolaters, and it seemed that none could resist them. Where was the Padi Raja? Where were his well-keepers, his grandees and their shining horses, and the water-bearers? Where were they? Smoke drifted faint and sheer over Shaima's western quarters. Ash fell like snow. Here and there, panicked groups were run down by the Kanraians in their silver masks without expression. The encounters were as disastrous as they were brief. Some careered into their countrymen, running in the opposite direction. Words of breathless horror were exchanged. Descriptions of the Crimson Courage, who blasted everything in their path, of the black-mailed Northmen swinging severed heads and hooting in animal voices. The idolaters seemed to be everywhere. But many stumbled onto the expanse of the Asharsa market, where the triangular pennant of a real grandee, Prince Hukal of Mongolia, awaited them, along with 400 riders, true desert men from the unforgiving plains of the Great Salt. The Amati conscripts found themselves arrayed in new ranks across the open Kabul, while the black-garbed prince cried out reminders of Fane and his indomitable courage. Soon, some 2,000 faithful occupied the open Kabul, their shoulders squared, their hearts renewed. And not a moment too soon. Melee had already engulfed the surrounding streets, where the Fainim defended hasty barricades against unmounted Kunrayan knights. The idolaters' numbers swelled as more and more of the bands ranging the streets joined the fracas. Those who came upon the market paused and only ventured to attack when several hundred of them had gathered. The Anplian barons and knights led the assault, eager to avenge the death of Shressa Gaedeki, their beloved Count Palatine. But they were undone, driven back by the charges of Hukal and his Mongolians.
Only when the Prince Nersay Proyas arrived with the Palatines in Gayaban and Genyati were they able to organize a determined assault. The Amati broke easily enough, fled into the eastern streets, many of which the Khanrayans had already overrun on the flanks. But the Mongolian horsemen proved far more stubborn, and their charges exacted a horrible toll. Even as their horses failed them, they fought with ferocious zeal. Lord Ganyati, the Palatine of Ankirioth, traded blows with mighty Prince Hukal himself. The heathen lord beat aside his shield and cracked his collarbone with a blow that snapped his scimitar. Lord Ganyati toppled back, was crushed by pommeling hooves. Death came swirling down. Led by the fury of Lord Proyas, the Khanrayans broke the heathen horsemen and recovered the Palatine's ravaged corpse. The Mongolians melted into the surrounding streets. Howling mighty oaths, the bereaved Ankiriothi raced after them. But the prince pulled Ingayaban aside.
"What is it?"
the burly Palatine said, his voice ringing through his war mask.
"Where are they?"
Proyas asked.
"The Phanum."
"What do you mean?"
"They only pretend to defend their city."
All Kellis could see of his father were two fingers and a thumb lying slack upon a bare thigh. The thumbnail gleamed.
"As Dunyane," the disembodied voice continued, "you had no choice. To command yourself, you had to master circumstance. And to master circumstance, you had to bind the actions of the worldborn to your will. You had to make limbs of nations. So you made their beliefs the object of your relentless scrutiny. It was axiomatic. You realized those truths that cut against the interests of the powerful were called lies, and that those lies that served those interests were called truths. And you understood that it had to be this way, since it is the function of belief, not the veracity, that preserved nations. Why call an emperor's blood divine? Why tell slaves that suffering is grace? It is what beliefs do, the actions they license and prohibit, that is important. If men believed all blood was equal, the caste nobility would be overthrown. If men believed all coin was oppression, the caste merchants would be turned out. Nations tolerate only those beliefs that conserve the great system of interlocking actions that makes them possible. For the worldborn, you realized, truth is largely irrelevant. Why else would they all dwell in delusion? Your first decision was elementary. You claimed to be a member of the caste nobility, a prince, knowing that, once you convinced some, you could demand that all act accordingly. And through this simple deception, you secured your independence. No other would command you, because they believed they had no right to command you. But how might you convince them of your right? One lie had made you their equal. What further lie might make you their master? Whatever their old ardor, their bodies remembered. When he closed his eyes, she was there, beneath him, about him, enclosing his every languorous thrust, gasping and crying out, gasping and crying out. He could feel himself balled like a fist within her, alive to her heat, her liquid clutch. She reached out for his face, pulled him down to her hot mouth. She sobbed as she kissed him.
"You were dead.
I came back for you. Anything, even the world.
Akka.
For you. Esme, Esmanette, gasping and crying out. Such a strange name for a harlot."
Sheets of mist wheeled out from the mighty subterranean cataract, soaking his hair to his scalp, his robes to his skin. False tears slipped down his cheeks as he listened.
"You understood that beliefs, like men, possessed hierarchies, that some commanded more than others, and that religious belief commanded most of all. What better demonstration could there be than the Holy War itself? That the actions of so many could be pitched with single purpose against so many native weaknesses, fear, sloth, compassion? So you read their scriptures,
scrutinized the authority of words over men. You saw the primary function of Inrithism, to anchor belief in what cannot be seen, and so assure the repetition of the manifold actions that give nations their form. To doubt their order, to question the way things are, is to question the God who was their creator. The God becomes the warrant of men in their station, and the arbitrary relations of power that are the truth of the emperor and the slave are covered over, nary to be seen. Not only do questions become hazards, heresies, they also become futile, for their answers lie nowhere in this world. The servant shakes his fist at the heavens, not his master. His father's voice, so much like his own, swelled to seize all the dead non-men spaces. And here you saw the shortest path, for you understood that this trick, which turns the eyes of the oppressed skyward and away from the hand that holds the whip, could be usurped to your ends. To command circumstance, you must command action. To command action, you must command belief. To command belief, you need only speak with the voice of heaven. You were Dunyane, one of the conditioned, and they, with their stunted intellects, were no more than children. From the heights of the ruined shrine of Azoria, Enrithi Hornsman, Tidoni belonging to Gothyalk's own household, saw it first, a twinkle followed by a thunderous roar. The lords of the Holy War had scoured the surrounding plains, had even sent scouting parties into the cloven roots of the Betmulla, but they had found no sign of Fenial or his heathen army. Aside from yielding Shaima, which the Enrithi commanders found difficult to believe, this could mean only one thing. The scouts, stationed across what heights the Sherazor plains offered, were ready, as was Earl Gothyalk, who held his several thousand surviving Tidoni in reserve, though for years assailing Shaima's walls had been his heart's most ardent dream. They had expected the Kianine to take the field, where their speed and mobility could be exercised to their full advantage. The manner, however, confounded them. Reports were sent to the Earl, who waited with his men just to the east of the encampment, describing heathen activity in the southeastern quarters of the holy city, the vicinity of the Tantanar Gate. He dispatched messengers to Kinjoza's Einani, whose flanks lay nearest to the movement, then ordered a general advance. Should the Fainim host begin issuing from one of the eastern gates, he was, as per the warrior prophet's hallowed instructions, to assemble along the river Jeshimal, securing its two bridges and one, quite treacherous, whitewater ford. Following standards bearing the circumfix, black on gold, the mail-draped Tidoni knights took the lead, trotting forward on their stolen horses. To their left, Holy Shaima boomed and smoked. Men laughed and pointed to Einani pennants on the many-towered Tatarkar walls. The pace was practiced, leisurely even. The inveterate old Earl did not consider time an issue, since it would take hours for the heathen to trickle through the gates, let alone form up for battle. But the gates were not thrown open. For weeks, the sappers had labored, undermining the foundations of their own defenses. Walls meant nothing, their bright-eyed Padiraja assured them, when schools went to war. Mathematicians from Nensifon were consulted, as was the great architect Gotoran Absuraki. Then the Kishorim were employed. For a time, the hornsmen at Azoria could only stare in astonishment. Light flashed, white, haloed by blue and indigo, then the faraway Tantanar Gate and tracts of adjoining wall simply dropped, dissolving into gigantic blooms of dust. The breeze was slow in drawing the obscuring cloud sheer. Several heartbeats passed where they could see only lumbering shadows. Then they saw them, mastodons, dozens of them, ramping the debris with broad timber rafts. By the time the hornsmen sounded their pealing alarm, the first of the Kianine horsemen were already racing across the Sherazor plains. The sound of the heathen drums suddenly redoubled. You need only convince them that the distance between their intellect and yours was the distance between the world and the outside. Do this,
and they would yield to you absolute authority, cede to you their utter devotion. The path was narrow, to be certain, but it was very clear. You cultivated their awe and their inklings, telling them things no man could know. You appealed to the spark of logos within them. You mapped the logic of their commitments, showed them the implications of the tenets they already held. You showed them beliefs fixed by truth rather than function. You made their fears and weaknesses plain. You showed them who they were, even as you exploited those weaknesses to your advantage. You gave them certainty, though all the world is mystery. You gave them flattery, though all the world is indifference. You gave them purpose, though all the world is anarchy. You taught them ignorance. And throughout, you insisted that you were only a man like any other. You even feigned anger when others dared voice their suspicions. You did not impose, and you never presumed. You conditioned. You gave one man a wheel, another an axle, another a harness or a box, knowing that sooner or later they themselves would put the pieces together, that the revelation would be theirs. You bound them with inferences, knowing that someday they would make you their conclusion. The clean-shaven face leaned into the uncertain light. It seemed a grinning skull through the veiling water. That they would make you their prophet. But even this wasn't enough. The lips continued. Those without authority lost nothing by inserting you between them and their gods, for they already yielded their actions to others. Servitude is the most instinctive of habits. But those with authority, to rule in the name of an absent king, is to rule outright. Sooner or later, the caste nobility had to move against you. Crisis was inevitable. Moenga stood, pale, indistinct, like a vapor exhaled by the earth. He stepped beneath the spouting eyes. For a moment, water sluiced about his figure. Then he was clear, dripping, standing eye to socket with his son, naked save for his sodden loincloth. Pubic curls darkened the linen, steam coiled about his beaded skin. This, the eyeless face said, was where the probability trance failed me. So you did not anticipate the visions? Kellis asked. His father's face remained absolute and impassive. What visions? It seemed that he had screeched his throat raw. Several moments passed, but eventually the red-robed sorcerers ceased their fell singing. The glitter of sorceries dampened, then dulled into nothingness. Drums throbbed beneath the cackling rush of fires, red fires. Eleazarus no longer laughed. Behind the forward cadres, he stood in the heart of the great swath of hell his school had hacked from the city. Fumes steamed about the shell of foundations, fires twined into roaring towers, walls rose like fins from mounds of smashed brick. On and on, through slow-rolling veils of smoke, back to the battered ridge that had been the mighty Tatokar walls. The slopes of the Jutaram reared above the curtains of flame, its heights fenced by the ramparts of the Heterene walls. So close, he had to crane his neck to see the dome and cornices of the Tesseract above the battlements. There they would find them, the assassins. The Kishoram had sent their invitation, and they had come. After innumerable miles and deprivations, after all the humiliation, they had come. They had kept their end of the bargain. Now it was time to balance the ledgers. Now. What kind of game do they play? No matter. He would raise all Shima if he had to, upend the very earth. Eleazarus pressed a crimson sleeve against his face. It came away dark with soot and sweat. Despite the protestations of Shalmessa, his Javra captain, he pushed aside the tall woven shields and strode to the tip of a monolithic finger of stone that jutted from the debris. Waves of heat buffeted him. Fight! He howled at the wavering images in the distance above. The black sky wheeled. Fight! Someone's hands pulled at him. He slapped them away. Sarasthenes.
There are Koran here, Ellie. Great numbers of them. Can't you feel them?
It would be good to bathe, Eleazarus thought inanely, to scrub this madness from him.
Of course, he snapped. Beneath the ruin, held fast by the dead.
The world about him seemed black and hollow and glittering white. Kellis raised his palm. My hands. When I look upon them, I see halos of gold. Scrutiny, calculation. I have not my eyes with me, Moenga said, and Kellis understood instantly that he referred to the asps used by his Kishorum brethren. I walk these halls by memory. For all the signs he betrayed, this man who was his father could be a statue of stone. He seemed a face without a soul. The god, Kellis said. He doesn't speak to you? Scrutiny, calculation. No. Curious. And from where does his voice hail? Moengus asked. From what darkness? I know not. Thoughts come. I know only that they're not mine. Another infinitesimal pause. He dips in the probability trance, the same as I. The mad say much the same, Moenga said. Perhaps your trials have deranged you. Perhaps. Scrutiny, calculation. It's not in your interest to deceive me. A stone-faced pause. Unless. Unless, Kellis said, I've come to assassinate you, as our Dunyane brothers have decreed. Is this your apprehension? Scrutiny, calculation. You have not the power to overcome me. But I do, Father. Another pause, imperceptibly longer. How? His father finally said. Could you know this? Because I know why you were compelled to summon me. Scrutiny, calculation. So you have grasped it. Yes. The thousandfold thought.